Presenter before the discussion is Laura Larson from Trinity College in Dublin, and her work considers the question of aesthetics, politics and art by looking at monuments and in relation to landscape, especially in Nigeria.
Kenya.
Yeah. No, I don't know where I'm
Yeah, so I'm going to take you on a brief historic tour of of public monuments in Nairobi, Kenya, and hopefully show you how the public monuments in Nairobi have evolved in tandem with the changing political and cultural context of the city. You can identify, Nairobi is a relatively young town. It was only founded in 1899 with the arrival of British colonialism. And I've identified roughly four periods in Nairobi's monumental history. So you've got the period in colonial Nairobi when public monuments stood in the city as visual links to the British Empire and as a means of asserting colonial and imperial power. And then there's a period, the transition period around independence, which was in 1963, when colonial identities and assertions of power were challenged, and challenges, colonial statues were removed, and new monuments put up. Then there's a period of so the first president of Kenya, President Kenyatta, after him, President Moi, his presidency became known as the Nyayo era. And this is really the period in which monuments became huge statements of power in the landscape and were put up in an effort to create a Kenyan national identity, as well as to legitimize and assert the power of the ruling party, Kenyan African National Union, and of President Moi himself. And then more recently, I'll just touch on the new phase in Nairobi's monumental landscape with the identification of named heroes. So looking at monuments as sites of meaning, the word monument comes from the Latin monere, meaning to remind or advise or instruct. So you can sort of look at them as being deliberately inserted into the landscape as messages to be read. And they're sites where memories converge, condense, conflict, and convey relationships between the past, the present, and also the future. And through their ability to visualize ideologies, public monuments and statues can be used to unravel the broader processes at work in the city. And I'd like to sort of tie them into ideas of power through the notion of memory, which is inherent in public monuments, and where the manipulation of memory controls what is forgotten and what is remembered in the official landscape. As Le Goff argues, collective memory has been an important issue in the struggle for power among social forces. To make themselves the master of memory and forgetfulness is one of the great preoccupations of the classes, groups, and individuals who have dominated and continue to dominate historical societies. And such power struggles play out in the urban landscape, where dominant groups or cultures are often better placed to visibly assert their dominance in the symbolic landscape. So to colonial Nairobi's monumental landscape, which provided a visual link with empire, monuments can briefly be grouped into three categories: monuments to British monarchs, First and Second World War memorials, and settler monuments. The first statue to be put up in Nairobi was a statue of Queen Victoria. As I mentioned, Nairobi was founded in 1899. The statue of Queen Victoria was unveiled on the 17th of March 1906 by the Duke of Connacht. It was the first royal family to visit Kenya. And the unveiling ceremony and choreography of events that surrounded the unveiling ceremony of this monument really acted to assert British authority in this really young town, but also to convey to the royal family that authority had been asserted. So the East African Standard at the time described how Nairobi was profusely decorated and its streets thronged with enthusiastic crowds and lined on either side by Maasai warriors, who gave a most picturesque effect to the whole scene. and were an excellent object lesson in loyalty to the more truculent members of other local tribes. So again, public participation in this ceremony, where it was actually donated to the city of Nairobi by an Asian businessman, unveiled by the Duke of Connacht. Both the Asian communities and the European communities had speeches at the ceremony. And again, Africans were treated more as sort of ornamental, if you like, in this ceremony. The other monuments to British monarchs in colonial Nairobi, King George V, and a bas-relief of King George VI, the memorial fountain. Terence Ranger describes how, in contrast to India, Africa did not offer its conquerors the framework of an indigenous imperial state, nor existing centralized rituals of honor and degree. Ready connections between African and European systems of governance could only be made at the level of the monarchy. Africa possessed, so the colonizers thought, dozens of rudimentary kings. Hence, in Africa, the British made an even greater use of the idea of imperial monarchy than they did within Britain or India. And the theology of an omniscient, omnipotent, and omnipresent monarchy almost became the sole ingredient of imperial ideology as it was presented to Africans. And so in colonial Kenya, you can see that they've really drawn this idea of an imperial aesthetic, if you like. And monuments to British monarchs really contributed to the construction of a landscape of colonial power. Celebration of the monarchy was, in addition, celebration of the monarchy was part of the process through which Britain linked its empire as a social entity through the reproduction in its periphery of its own perceived domestic social hierarchy. And the empire was symbolized through these monarchical figures, where the persons of the Queen Empress and King Emperors formed an imperial aesthetic. And not only were they used to assert colonial authority in Nairobi, but they were also used to assert Kenya's place in the empire and to prove to the imperial power the country's position as a loyal member of the empire. Then alongside those monuments, British monarchs, we have the First and Second World War memorials, which again provide visually linked Kenya with the rest of the empire. These were all funded, designed, put up by the Imperial War Graves Commission, which had a standardized way of collectively remembering those who died in the World Wars. What's interesting about these is that in the First World War, two separate collective memories were created. Those for the British and Indian officers and men who died in the war, who are remembered in the Nairobi South Cemetery, and whose names are listed on this green wall. But the Africans who died in the same war are remembered in a different location in the city through this African War Memorial, which is very similar in form to memorials put up in Dar es Salaam in Tanzania, Mombasa in Kenya as well. And they're very contrasting in form, as you can see the figurative form of this and the screen wall form of that. By the Second World War, the Africans who died were incorporated into the wider imperial landscapes of remembrance. And these landscapes of remembrance, as I said, sort of followed a commemorative language common throughout the empire. They had very strict sort of templates. Then alongside, again, in colonial Nairobi, I won't go too much into this, but the settler monuments to settlers, which was a way the settlers asserted their own power in the country. But looking into the history of these monuments also uncovers power tensions between the settler community, the white settler community, and the white or the colonial government in the country. Then coming up to independence, we have this transition period with removal of colonial era monuments and the erection of new monuments. Coming up to independence, the colonial government discussed the statues and other monuments to the great of the colonial era and the deep offence which would be caused, particularly among the European settlers, if, in the enthusiasm of self-government and then independence, there were to be any desecration, disfigurement, or other manifestations in respect of disrespect in relation to these monuments. And I would argue that, in a way, this period highlights some underlying resistance. Monuments very much, I guess, you know, the dominant group displaying its idea of identity, asserting its power, but ordinary public can make its voice heard in the monumental landscape through vandalism, for example, as happened in 1958 when the Queen Victoria statue was toppled from its pedestal. And I would argue to a certain extent that this resistance also expressed itself around this transition period with the removal of colonial era monuments. Although you can, through a post-colonial lens, you can also look at it as a transfer of power between the change in dominant groups, where the colonized with the subaltern in colonial Kenya, and in post-colonial Kenya, the dominant is the small group of the political elite, and the rest of the population the subaltern. And this shift in power brought with it the power to control what was forgotten and what was remembered in the landscape. As Le Goff highlights again, the power to destroy memory is a counterweight to power achieved through the production of memory. So at this time we have the removal of colonial era monuments, which created the symbolic space in the landscape for the writing of new post-colonial narratives and the assertion of post-independence identities. And the first two monuments to be put up in Kenya after independence were statues of Jomo Kenyatta, Kenya's first president. As you can see, they're quite—they're very similar in form to the colonial statues. They bronze figurative statues. Creating a continuity with Nairobi's colonial monumental landscape. And they were also both sculpted in England brought out to Kenya. It was a sort of tentative effort here at creating a post-independence identity, if you like. It was only once Kenyatta died, Moi was elected unopposed as the head of the only party, the ruling party, Kenya African National Union. And it was during his presidency that monuments take on a completely different form and create this post-colonial aesthetic, if you like. Moi's presidency became known as the Nyayo era, and also as an era of state repression. Just to briefly go over the idea of Nyayo and Nyayoism. Nyayo means footsteps, and it was a slogan employed to emphasize the continuity that marked Moi's presidency as he declared his intention to follow in the footsteps of Kenyatta, the father of the nation. And as well as continuity in policies between Kenyatta and Moi, Moi developed Nyayoism as an ideological philosophy, and he emphasized that this philosophy was built on the foundational tenets of love, peace, and unity. And in addition, as promoting Nyayoism, thank you, as a nation-building ideology, he employed the philosophy as a means to assert, advertise, and legitimize KANU's authority, and also his own power as leader of KANU. So also fundamental to Nyayoism was the role of KANU, where Moi emphasized that there are three important factors in the Kenyan style of nation building: the vehicle, the force, and the philosophy. KANU is the vehicle, which is the ruling party. Nyayo is the moving spirit or force, and Nyayoism is the philosophy. And so he demanded that in order to achieve the Kenya we want in peace, love, and unity, all wananchi, which citizens, must pledge undivided loyalty and commitment to the nation, the head of state, the ruling party, and the government. So during this era of state repression, there was an attempted coup in Kenya in 1982, and lots of opposition to Moi's government. And these monuments were all put up in a highly charged political context, and common to them, most of them, is their large, imposing size and their dominating presence in the landscape, claiming solidity and stability. They will put up in celebration of independence as well. So we have, the Nyayo Monument in Huru Gardens and the Nyayo Fountain in Huru Park, which were both put up in celebration of 20 years of independence. And then the 25th Independence Anniversary Fountain, which celebrates 25 years of independence. And also the Nyayo Monument in Central Park, which celebrates 10 years of Moi's presidency, and also which happened to fall in the same year as 25 years of independence. And so, as I mentioned, they're all put up during anniversaries, or in celebration of anniversaries, and celebrate independence. And through these monuments, the political elite claimed the memory of the moment of independence to validate their authority and to associate themselves with the independent country. As I mentioned, they're all highly symbolic in both their size and also their form, and form this post-colonial aesthetic which contrasts quite strongly with the colonial monuments, which were more figurative and literal in their form. Instead, these Nyayo era monuments are a mixture of symbolic images and concepts, as befits the palimpsestual tension in post-colonialism. They are more abstract and metaphorical. A lot of them emphasize the peace, love, and unity aspect of the Nyayo philosophy in a three-sided. There's a mixture of symbols that can be seen as African, such as the Kanu cockerel, which denotes an African leader. Similarly, the Rungu, of representative of Moi's presidency, again here, and the fly whisk, representative of Kenyatta's presidency. Both symbols denote African leader. Symbols that can be seen a bit more universal, such as the color white for peace, and the dove, the image of a dove for peace. The image of a happy family is a metaphor for the nation. Images that perhaps a bit more Western, such as here the flag-raising image in the Nyayo Monument, which is very similar to the Iwo Jima flag-raising image. Some imagery which can be seen a bit more socialist style, such as the industry medallion of the Nyayo Monument. In addition, these monuments all invite the citizens to participate in the celebration of the nation state. Often they had these viewing, space for the viewing of the monuments, and this one in particular was constructed to sort of act as an amphitheater or a space for performance, although it never ended up performing that role. So the constellation of ideas embodied in these monuments attempts to legitimize as well as assert Kanu's authority. In addition, they seek to demand loyalty to the ruling party and through a national identity to the nation state, and also to Moi himself. And then I just wonder, with the plurality of races, ethnicities, cultures, and identities in Kenya, perhaps the idea of a Kenyan nation is an abstract idea, as the monuments too are abstract constructions. I don't have that much time left, but just briefly to touch on, although these monuments are sort of put up as statements of power, they also do provide the symbolic space for the ordinary public to make their voice heard at times. So in February 1990, the Nyayo Monument was damaged by student demonstrators. More recently, in October 2004, again, the Nyayo Monument was a target of protests, when members of the Released Political Prisoner Pressure Group demanded the Truth, Justice and Reconciliation Commission be established in Kenya, and the Nyayo Monument was defaced with paint, slogans Monument of Shame and Nyayo Era was scrubbed out in Nyayo Era Prison. Okay. I was going to go a bit through looking at Nairobi's monuments, how you can look at it through post-colonial lens and look at monuments as where a lot of post-colonial scholars see consider power through culture to be the principal tool of imperialism, and how monuments can be treated as cultural artifacts, and this how they continue to be used in post-independence Kenya as tools in the assertion of power. Last slide. And more recently, Nairobi's symbolic landscape has taken on a different aesthetic, if you like. It's back to the more figurative statuary. Again, it's very much at the moment, I haven't sort of spent much time looking into it this much, but as far as I can tell, still very much state-dominated. And they're trying to identify and name heroes in the attempt to create a Kenyan national identity. But there is a bit more public participation now, in the respect that the public are invited to help identify these heroes. But ultimately, it is still very much a state-controlled process. Thank you very much. Thank you.